This is the report of this work from November the 5th, or November 2005 to just this year. When we moved to Duluth, a few months ago, or a few years ago, the church there was very small. And if you want to know something about the city and where it is, and this may explain why it was so small to some degree, it's very much in the tip of the Great Lakes. It's the very end of the Great Lakes. And it's the fourth largest city in the state. It's a city made up of 86,000. It has gone down in number over the last 7 years, they say, so it's going to be interesting how the census goes this year. But they reckon it's lost some of the population because in that area it's somewhat depressed with regard to work and things like that. So men do not really move there too often. And what happens is all the children seem to grow up, get their education, and leave. Kind of sad. But there is a good base of people there who just want to be in Duluth and who love Duluth and who wouldn't move for anything because they just want to be in that area. And indeed, it is a very pretty place. Duluth has a port which attracts probably the majority of its income. It's a port for saltwater vessels. A lot of people don't realize this. They think of Duluth as being just a salt or a freshwater port, you know, because it's on the Great Lakes. And how in the world would any ships from overseas or ships from other countries come to Duluth? Well, they come through the locks. They come up the St. Lawrence Seaway, and they travel 2,300 miles to go to Duluth. And from Duluth, they pick up their grain. They pick up ore. They pick up their propellers for their windmills, and it's pretty interesting to just see the ships come in from all over the world and to pick up their stuff and then to leave. And it's a very busy port. It's not as busy as the port in Chicago, but it's very busy. The picture up on the left is a picture of the shipping season. The picture on the bottom is a picture that I took just a few weeks ago, and you can see the ice on the lake. I guess you can see it up there. Yeah, there's ice there on the lake. And this year, it hasn't been as cold as it has been in previous years, and so our ice wasn't as thick on the lake as it has been. But there's a picture of Duluth in the winter and all that. The Duluth Church was actually started back in 1953. My mother and father-in-law, the Crumrise, had gone through Duluth on their honeymoon, and they loved the city, and they noticed there was no church there at all. At least not one they could find. And so after their honeymoon was over, they went back to St. Louis, where they were living at the time, and they made preparations, and eventually in 1953, they moved to Duluth and established a congregation. And until the 60s, the congregation was steadily growing. I don't recall how big it was. I can't remember Melvin telling me how big it was, but it was a substantial size. And then when the institutional question came to the front, a division took place, which meant that Melvin and Alice had to start all over again and establish another congregation in the city. They were pretty much asked to leave. And they were the ones who kind of kept this work going all over all these years. They have been the ones that have always been there. They have been the ones that were always trying to keep things going and trying to do the work of the Lord there in that place. And it wouldn't be fair to mention the church in Duluth and mention the work without mentioning them and their contribution to it. When we first moved to the congregation back in 2005, the congregation was made up of 9 people altogether. It was Melvin and Alice. It was Nick and Ruth, and that's Patty's brother. And Melvin and Alice's son, Daniel and Heather Bunting. Daniel is married to Heather. Heather is actually Nick and Ruth's daughter, and Betsy Messick. So in the first 7 people that we mentioned there are all related to the Crumrise. In essence, it was kind of a little Crumrise congregation. And that's not said as a criticism, because as we all know, when a church starts somewhere, very often it's just the family members that get to meet together. And so a lot of times just family is there, and then it starts growing. But when we got there, it was still pretty much a Crumrise congregation. There were 2 other people there, Doug Kennedy, who had moved there from the Carolinas. And Doug is one of these extraordinary people who just like cold weather and like snow. He's tempted to move away this year because we haven't had enough snow. But he's there. He's a weatherman. And he's there. He's in the right place. And then the other girl who was there was a student at UMD named Lauren Gust. And she was the other person who was there. And so the congregation was made up of this when we first moved there. And that was our meeting place at the time there on 318 North, 18th Avenue East. And that building was bought in the late 70s. And we have been using it as a meeting house and classrooms ever since. Now, when we sold our meeting place, or we haven't sold it yet, when we bought our new meeting place this last summer, this is the congregation that was there then. And you can see the numbers had quite changed quite a bit. And actually, in this particular picture, there were four Christians who weren't present. But we had 26 Christians altogether in that length of time. So you can see that over the time that we were there, and this time we hadn't been there 3 years yet, the congregation grew from 9 to 26, and out of that original 9, 1 had passed away, 2 had moved back to the Northeast to work there in New Jersey, and Lauren Gust had gotten married after she converted her husband and moved to Alaska. So we had a lot of the original ones had already left, and this congregation here is what we have, our list, what we had when we moved from our old building to the new building. And I could say there were 26 Christians in all. So a lot of work had taken place. Now, out of this number here, there were two families that had moved in. The fellow on the bottom with his leg stuck out is the Harrington family. They had moved in from Hayward, Wisconsin. They live there, but they drive up to Duluth to worship. That's about 90 miles away. And then another couple, the woman on the left with the white blouse and her husband, the Mayfields, they came from Pennsylvania. He's originally from Texas, but she's from Minnesota. And when she finished getting her doctorate, she moved back up to Duluth where she could practice her trade. And they bought a house there to settle in. But everybody else who is there pretty much, beside the original group, are people that we had converted, are people that we had taught the gospel since we had been there, which is a nice, it was a good thing. I mean, you can just see there was just a lot of activity that had taken place in the few years that we were there. Another thing that had happened during that time is that we had a young man named Taylor Ladd come to start work with us. We have been pretty busy for the first 2 years we were there, and I was doing lots of studies throughout the week. And an opportunity came for the congregation to invite a young man who had come to work with the Northwest Church there in where Rick Lanning is. I think y'all had him here for a meeting a while back. Well, Rick Lanning had and the congregation of Northwest had brought Taylor up there to kind of work with them during the summer, but in hopes that perhaps he would like Minnesota and maybe stay somewhere. And so what happened was at the end of his time there, Taylor and I met together, and he asked if he could come to Duluth and to maybe work with us up there, because he knew the work was going well. He knew there was lots to do, and we had a conversation with the congregation, and a visit with the men got together with him and decided he would be able to come up and work with us. And he's really been a help. I mean, both of us are busy every night of the week. I mean, that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. He's busy and I'm busy. Sometimes we do kind of across each other's paths, and have some studies together. But for the most part, he has his own studies and I have my studies. And on most nights, he's as busy as I am with that. So there's just a lot going on there. And it's just a great blessing. And again, here's just another picture, or no, at least the names of the new Christians that make up the congregation there in Duluth. It's pretty much a new congregation, even though it was established when we were there, because there had been so many conversions, it's just quite different than what it was when we first arrived. And we're very blessed to have such a tremendous amount of growth, and the Lord has been very, very good to us. Since we moved to our new meeting place, and I'll show you a better picture of it in just a minute, we've had four more additions to the congregation, so now we're 30. We're 30 Christians in all there at the church in Glenwood Street there in Duluth. And they have the stars there, and underneath there are the new people that have joined us. Rennie had been a Christian that had fallen away and came back to the Lord. Zach and Jen were converted. And then the Sean and Holly Niehaus on the very bottom, they had moved to the city a few years ago. They were already Christians, but they had worshiped with some of the institutional church, in the other institutional churches in town. There's two of them. And they didn't like either one of them. And so they started well, they actually fell away and started meeting with the Covenant Church in Duluth, one of the Covenant churches. And then they learned and they decided that wasn't right either. So they started meeting in their home. And then one day they were driving down the road and they saw our sign at the new meeting place. And then they came by and visited with us, and they've actually placed membership with us. But these are the new additions that we've had. When I write my reports, I always try to talk about the people that I study with, just so people can have kind of get a feel of what we're doing. And what I've done here is given some pictures of the studies that I have throughout the week. Up here on the left there, or at least my left, I guess it's your left too. Yes, it is. We have a study here with Karen White and Taylor. Taylor's on the right, of course, and Karen is on the left. We met her through an ad we had in the paper. We had an ad that said, wanted people to seriously study the Bible with. What was funny about this ad was I had run this before. But before I had run the ad, I said, wanted people to study the Bible with. And I thought that was enough. And then my brother-in-law, Nick, said, well, in New York City, the Buntings, Brother Bunting put an ad up there, and he said, wanted people to seriously study the Bible with. And I said, are you kidding? I said, just one word? He said, he's got so many studies, he doesn't know what to do with them. And so we added, I said, well, if that, you think that'll work. So I put the word seriously in there, and seriously it worked. It was, we get calls, run this ad, and people call. And they call, first of all, wondering, what do we want to do? And then I've had lots of studies through this particular method, and Karen is one of them. She's a young woman that called me up. She said she had seen the ad before. But was a little bit frightened to call. You know, you don't know what you're getting into when you're calling something like this. But we talked on the phone. She asked me what we were trying to do. And I said, well, really, we're just trying to go to the scriptures. We're trying to just read them together and learn what the text says. Not what we think it means or not what it just means to me, but what did it mean when it was first written? And go back to the intent of the apostles, the intent of the writer. And she said, well, that's what I want to do. And I said, well, that's good. And I said, well, what do you want to study? And she said, I like to study the Gospel of Matthew. Well, that was great because that's what I like to study when I'm having these kind of studies. And I like to have studies in familiar books, because what happens is that people feel they're familiar enough with Matthew or Mark that they don't feel like you're pulling the wool over their eyes. You know, they know something about these books. So if you study some, like one of the epistles, which they've maybe never studied before or don't know much about, they're a little more vulnerable to maybe being beguiled by the teacher. And so I try to study something that's familiar, and she wanted to study this, and we've been studying it, and she's been a great student. She goes to a Baptist church in the city, and we're hoping, we're going to have a meeting when I go back in April with Carl Disselkamp, and we're hoping that she'll come to the meeting. We've invited her. She said she would like to come, but it's been a joy to study with her. We study on Monday night at 5 o'clock in the evening at the Caribou Coffee House there in Duluth near the harbor that you saw a picture of earlier. And then after that study, I go home and have a quick bite to eat. And then I go to Sean and Holly's house, and they're just around the corner from us and our meeting place. And then this is the young couple that had that were Christians and then moved to Duluth and then fell away and then came back. And that's them there. And they're a joy to study with. Both of them were converted by an in an institutional congregation. And so there are some differences, and they understand the differences. We've already talked about them, but they're happy enough that we're trying to go back to the Bible. They're happy enough to realize that we want authority for what to do. And so they've thrown in their lot with us, knowing the differences and knowing what we're about. And so far, they've been just a great joy to have. And again, we'll have to wait and see how things go as time goes on. But they're a blessing to the congregation, I have to say. They're a blessing in a number of ways because first of all, they're just a young couple, a stable couple, a married couple, and another thing is they have children. And for the last 20 years, there's been no children in Duluth. There's been no children in the congregation. The congregation has been pretty much an older person congregation. And so this is the first time in years there's been children in the congregation, which is a great blessing. Later on, I'll show you a picture of them. And then on Tuesday, I study at 7 o'clock in the morning with the couple on the left, Zach and Jen. They're new Christians. And then that evening I studied with Tara. Tara is actually the girl on the left, the top left. That's with her friend Becky. She's one of the other Christians there. And then Andrew on the bottom. We studied together with them on Tuesday evenings. And then on Wednesday morning at about 11 o'clock, I studied with Linda. Linda's the lady on the left. She also responded to the ad, wanted someone to seriously study the Bible with. And, we've been studying with her. She goes to a very modern church there in Duluth. And it's a church that really doesn't do much Bible reading at all. And so when we're studying with her, she really is truly a novice. She's finding it difficult to find the books in the Bible. She doesn't really know anything about the history of the Bible. So it's really been a challenging study, but a good study. I mean, she really wants to learn, and that's great. The lady on the right is Mary. She's one of the Christians there in Duluth. And she goes with me to this study. We meet in a public restaurant or a public coffee house there in the city every Wednesday. And then on Thursday, I study again with Mary and her husband, Jim. Now Jim and Mary were the first people that I saw being baptized in Duluth when we moved there. They were actually going to the congregation before we moved there. And so in essence, they were really taught by Nick and Ruth, or Nick and Melvin and Alice and Ruth. They were taught the gospel them. Her conversion is kind of funny. We were talking about doing street work. And she said to me after I had made an announcement we're going to do some street work, she says to me, I'd really like to go out in the street and do some work with you, to, you know, spread the gospel around. I said, Mary, I'd like you to go out too, but I would like you to, first of all, become a Christian. And she kind of looked at me and she said, what do you mean? I said, well, you're not a Christian, Mary, you know. And you know, she'd been going for this time, and even though she had been talked to about this, I guess nobody had just put it as clear as that. And about 2 weeks later, she was immersed into Christ. And since then, she's had her ups and downs with regard to her faith, but she's been pretty steady, at least especially during the last, year. And her husband, he's the oldest man in the congregation. I guess he's a little bit younger than Melvin. I have to take that back. But, we baptized him before he became a Christian. He had his voice box removed and has that hole there and everything. So we were kind of concerned about baptizing him. I mean, we knew he knew he had to be, but we were just a little bit concerned about how we were going to stop the water from flowing in. But he had no hesitation. He just said, I'll get a towel and I'll just put it over my throat and be immersed. And so, when people say that this is a problem, well, it is a problem, but it's not one that can't be overcome. So he was immersed there. The lady on the bottom, and I don't have a good picture of a husband, is the lady who lives in Hayward, Wisconsin. I travel there about twice a month on a Thursday night to study with her and her husband and one other Christian there in Hayward. The Harrington family started the work in Hayward several years back. I'm going to say maybe 15 years back at least. And then the last couple of years, some bad influences come in the congregation, and most of this influence was very much in favor of institutional things, and the Harringtons had pretty much had tried to teach the congregation and guide them in a certain way, because especially since they've been the one who started it. But what happened was is that the other members over pretty much decided they were going to go a certain direction, and the Harringtons were forced out. So instead of now meeting there in Hayward, Wisconsin, they go to Duluth pretty much on a regular basis. Now, the church has really grown quite a bit. Not counting the people that have moved in, we probably had about 15 or 16 conversions. So, and then we have others who have moved in, so it gets up to 30. But I want to stress that the reason why the church has grown since we have been there has really not been because of anything that I have done or Taylor has done. What we have in Duluth, and this is really wonderful, is that we have a lot of people in Duluth, young Christians, who really are interested in bringing their friends to the Lord. And probably the most significant individual in the congregation who has been responsible for the conversion of really several people is Becky Messick, my cousin by marriage. She's a beautician by trade, you know, a lowly beautician. She likes to gab. And she likes to talk to her friends and her acquaintances. And what happened is that as a result of her influence, she's converted Tara. It was through her that Tara was converted. It was through her that Andrew was converted. And Stacy, her best friend, was converted. She was the one who got studies going with these people. Now, she invited Taylor and I to join these studies, to be sure. She didn't feel equipped to actually teach these people. But if it had not been for her and for her asking these people, would they like to join a study? Would they like to learn the scriptures? These people here would have still been in the world. They would have not been Christians. So she is a wonderful person. I have a name down there at the bottom, Derek, and he's on the very bottom on the right-hand side. I don't have a picture of him. He's a shy fellow. And he's not as faithful as he ought to be either. We're trying to encourage him along, but he was actually converted through Becky as well. Becky and Taylor and Stacy were one day studying the scriptures in a restaurant in Wisconsin, or Superior, Wisconsin, at a Culver's, and they were reading the Bible, and Derek was working there, and he was sweeping the floor, but he kept coming by. He kept seeing what they were doing, but he kept coming by sweeping so he could listen to what was being said. And so as a result of this, they started talking to him until it became an embarrassment for them talking to this guy who should be working. And that they got a study with him, and he too became a Christian. So I kind of credit her and Stacy for his conversion as well, because it was because they were studying there that he was actually converted. Stacy, you know, when you have a good example from somebody else, you tend to follow it. And we all know that to be true as parents. Especially. But Stacy too is very interested in bringing people to the Lord. And she was converted, and as a result of her, Jen and Zach have been converted to the Lord. She is also one who likes to talk to people and likes to invite people. Stacy is also a beautician. And, you can tell by her name Gunderson. She's, from the Scandinavian part of Europe, or her family is, which is kind of common there in Duluth. Most people there are from Finland or from Sweden or places like that, Norway. And, but she talked to Jen and Zach and brought them to the Lord. Calvin Cook is a young man that was converted in Pine City, moved up to Duluth, and he has a job at Walmart. And on the evenings, he has time when they have their lunch break at midnight or so. He talks to his friend, and as a result of him talking to a young of his workmates, Andrew Hall was converted. And later on, Andrew helped convert his wife, who a woman who became his wife, Stephanie. So again, these are people who have done the work. All Taylor and I have done, and me especially, is I've just been there to teach these people when they were brought by others, you know, to a study. So I've been just, they've been doing all the work, and I've just been there. This is Lauren Gust, who moved away. She not only helped convert Melanie Halverson, but she converted her husband as well. He before they got married, and she converted him, and then they moved off to Alaska for his work. But Melanie is a science student there at UMD. She's a science major. She's finishing her degree this year. Hopefully she'll stay on in Duluth, because she's a very special person to us, and also she's dating Taylor. I know Taylor would like for her to stay because they're getting somewhat serious. But Melanie was responsible for converting one of her classmates, who's also a science major, Heather Freeberg, and she's on the bottom left in the yellow. Heather's a science student, and she was converted through Melanie's intervention. Melanie invited her to come to a Bible study. She invited Heather to meet me, so we met at a Perkins restaurant, talked a little bit about things, and she was very interested, and she said she would like to study with Melanie and I, so we studied, and as a result, she became a Christian later on. Sadly, the girl in the blue, on the top of the picture there, she too was converted last summer. That's not sad that she was converted, but sadly, once she was converted, she moved away back to the Twin Cities to go to school. She was converted out of the Assemblies of God churches. But when she went back, she was actually going to Assembly of God school. And when she moved back to the city, she kind of pretty much went back into that. But maybe if she moves back to Duluth, we'll have some more influence on her. But again, I want to stress the reason I bring in these kind of things up is to show that the work has progressed like it has, because we have people there who have a mind to work. people who are really interested in the Lord and who are interested in bringing people to Christ. And that's been a great blessing for us. This is some of the things that we do when we do work in Duluth. We only do this kind of work in the summer. Obviously, if you know anything about Duluth, it gets really cold there. You can't do street work in the cold. When it's 40 below and the wind is howling, you don't go outside. And if the wind's not howling, you still don't go outside. You stay indoor. But when the spring comes, we'll be out there on the lake walk putting up this little box that we have. It was a brainchild of a brother in the cities who tried it out where he works or where he lives. And what we do, we have questions, and then we have a yes or no button, red and green button, and people press the buttons to see yes or no, and if they get the right answer, the light shines. If it's the wrong answer, it buzzes, and it's been it's resulted in lots and lots of good conversation with people about the Lord. People are very curious, well, how much do they know about the Bible? And what we do with this, we have very easy questions in the very first two columns. Then we come to the harder questions about conversion in the last part. So we don't want to run them off. We want them to kind of get in the swing of things. But it really is interesting. When you have a question up there, where was Jesus born? Jerusalem, Nazareth, Bethlehem, or Cana. How many people don't know the answer to that? And, we think, well, everybody knows he was born in Bethlehem. And not everybody doesn't know that. I'll be up there. They'll be thinking that, so I'll start singing "Little Town of Bethlehem," and trying to help them out. And Bethlehem, but it's most people. A lot of people press Jerusalem, or sometime Nazareth. That's up there because they hear Jesus of Nazareth. We say no, he grew up there, but that's not where he's born. But it's amazing how little people know, but yet it has resulted in some really really excellent conversations on the street. And though we have not converted anyone through this yet, we've made our presence known in the city because of efforts like this. Taylor and I have. We have neighborhood festivals in the spring. Once spring comes, everybody gets out and there's just lots of activity because our summer and our kind of nice season only lasts from about June until about September. So we have a real short time to be doing things outside. And sometime we have an Indian summer in October, but we do a lot of things outside, and so we're just busy with neighborhood festivals, and we have a booth out there where people come up and talk to us. We have county fairs to go to locally, where we hand out leaflets and talk to people. And again, we have had lots of good conversations through this. Now, like I said earlier, we have changed our meeting place. We now meet in this building here. And when I show it, I'm somewhat embarrassed because it's so huge. And it can hold probably about 120 people. But what happened was we were growing so much, and the older building was not really capable of holding us and also our cars. There was just no place to park when people came. And so we started looking around, and we found out that to buy a piece of land in the city was just astronomical. And so all of a sudden, this old church building came on the market. And this church building was cheaper on the land that it was on than a piece of land. And then we have to build and get all that stuff done. So we bought this, and it's pretty. It's built in 58, in pretty good shape. And this is the inside of it. We've used it in the summer, in the last part of the summer when we were there, but you can see the roof is very high. We're probably going to eventually lower that roof because it's just too expensive to heat that space up there, but we'll have to wait and see. But you can see we put a little the little gray thing on the right hand side. There's a wall we put up which kind of keeps the room small. So in other words, when people come in, they're forced to sit in the front. We don't allow them to sit in the back. We keep it shut off. But when we get up there this spring, we'll be moving that back because we've grown so much since we put that up there. This is the two young people. This is our first children's Bible class in years, and Patty's there with the two young boys, Rhett and Tate. Their characters, but it's really fun to have the pitter-patter of little feet in the congregation or hear it going on, the little voices there. It's just, you don't know what it's like to be in a congregation without kids. And And really, it really is a sign of a dying congregation when you have no kids. And it's great to see this happening, and it brings life to the congregation, even though they're not Christians. But it just means there's hope for the future as we grow and have more families coming. And of course, with them, with the new knee houses coming along now, we're hoping that they may attract some of their friends who have family as well. This is our meeting. Where we meet now, we don't meet upstairs because it's too expensive to heat. Right now, in the winter, we're meeting in the basement. The basement is huge. It used to be a big fellowship hall for the Episcopalian church there. And so, we have two sections of chairs. And, in this particular meeting, we had 38 people there at the meeting, which was really neat. You know, it was one of the biggest assemblies we've had in years, and that was just a Sunday morning. So, it was good. And we did have a few visitors, of course, there, but that's the situation. And, that's it. That's about the work there. And you can turn that off, who's ever in charge of that, so you don't have to see it anymore. But you can see there's been a lot of work done there in Duluth. Before I forget, because I want to say a few things about evangelism, or a few things about how we go about evangelizing in just a minute, but I really do want to tell you how much I've appreciated the congregation here helping us in this. You've done a great work helping this. I know sometimes we don't realize how important it is to do evangelism or to help support people, and I know the congregation here is a good congregation for supporting people. But it really has it's freed me up. It's been able to let me devote myself not to worry about the finances, but to be concerned about the Lord's work. And it's really shown. It's really shown. I think what the church here in Duluth needed over the years, was somebody who could devote their full time to the work. Melvin, was a hard worker. And is a hard worker. He's still alive. He's 81 years old. But Melvin would go to work in the morning at 5 o'clock. He was a tree doctor. So he'd be going out there working in the winter. He'd be plowing snow early in the morning. And when he would come in the evening, he'd be exhausted. And so for him to be able to have regular Bible studies every night like I have would be an impossibility. There's only so much a man can bear before they just crush under the pressure of just never getting sleep. So he did the best that he could, but what's happened in the last few years is shown that when you have a man who is able to devote their full time to a work like this, especially in Duluth, that it makes a whole lot of difference, regarding, what can be done. Like, I can get up in the morning very early to study with those who need to be studied with early. I can go to bed very late. If I'm studying with somebody who needs a late night study, I can take off and eat lunch with somebody and study with them. I mean, this gives me the freedom. And this is what, when you help support a man to do this sort of thing, this is what it does. Just frees his time up to do pretty much what he needs to do in reaching out to the Lord, or reaching out to the lost for the Lord. And again, I really do appreciate the help. And had it not been for yourselves and others like you, this work could not have gone on as successfully, I believe, as what it has over the last few years. I do want to talk a little bit as we kind of draw this to a close. I want to bring some things together if I can. You know, very often when we are trying to teach people the gospel like we are in Duluth and like you are here in this place, there is a temptation to perhaps feel that we need to somehow compromise our message in order to attract greater numbers. In Duluth, and I've seen a lot of church planters come and go. People from denominations coming in, trying to plant new churches. And what they do, they get a survey sheet, and they go knocking on doors, and they ask questions regarding religion to these people at the doors. They'll say, do you go to church? And of course, most people say no, or very, very rarely do I go to church. And then they'll write that down. They say, well, why not? And they say, well, the preacher's boring. The service is, you know, too long. And they'll kind of make all these complaints, and these people are writing these things down, or at least that's what they're claiming to do, writing all these things down. And then at the end of the survey, they'll say, what if I told you of a church that we didn't have a boring preacher and we had, you know, a worship that was more fun and all this kind of stuff. And what these people are doing, they try to let the world determine what they're going to be preaching. Instead of preaching what the world needs to hear, they want the world to determine what they are going to be preaching so they can attract more people in the world to come to their assemblies. And of course, churches like that do tend to grow very fast because people have itching ears. And they want to hear certain things. They want to have their ears tickled. And sadly, sometimes brethren get caught up in that sort of thing. Maybe not to that drastic extent, but sometimes they get caught up in this idea that we need to somehow compromise our message and not be so plain with people regarding the gospel. Let's back off a little bit and let's kind of adapt to the culture some. The problem with that is that it's contrary to the whole spirit of New Testament Christianity. And when you go to the scriptures, and all of you here are familiar with some of the things I'm about to say, you'll find out that when Jesus was alive on the earth, Jesus never promised his people that they would be popular. He never promised his people that people would love to come and hear them talk or love to hear the things they have to say. In fact, he told them the very opposite. Turn, if you will, to Luke chapter 6 and verse 22, where Jesus, in the very beginning of his ministry, in his Sermon on the Mount, says to the people whom he had been talking to, blessed are you when men hate you and ostracize you and insult you and scorn your name as evil for the sake of the Son of Man. Be glad in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way their fathers used to treat the prophets. Jesus predicted that his disciples would be hated, that his disciples would be ostracized, that his disciples would be insulted and their names would be scorned because of their association with him. And this wasn't the only time he promised this. In Matthew chapter 10, when his popularity was gaining and more and more people were following him, on one occasion he turns around, and I've always thought that if Jesus had a PR man, that this man would have fainted dead away to hear what the Lord was about to say. But here a crowd was following him, and in Matthew 10 and verse 21, he says to them, brother will betray brother to death, and his father, his child, and children rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all because of my name. But it is the one who endures to the end who will be saved. And then later on down in verse 34, he says, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother-in-law, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his own house. And he was telling the Christians that this is going to be your lot if you follow me. You're going to be hated, not just by other people, but by even your own family. They will hate you because of me. And even on the night in which he was betrayed, as he was eating with the disciples during his last meal with them, Jesus says in John 15 and verse 18, he says to them, he says, if the world hates you, speaking to his apostles, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you are of the world would love its own, but because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. And so right on the very night of his betrayal, he tells the apostles that you will be hated by the world. You will be hated by the world because you follow me. And then when Jesus dies, his apostles taught the early Christians the same thing. In 1 John chapter 3, we see John writing in verse 13 when he said, do not be surprised, brethren, if the world hates you. Don't be surprised at this, if the world hates you. And then as we go on, we see on occasion in the book of Acts where Paul was traveling back to Antioch, where he had started his first missionary journey. As he was going back, visiting the churches that he established, he tells them in Acts chapter 14 and verse 22, through many tribulations you must enter the kingdom of God. Peter spoke of this as well. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 14, he warns the Christians, and he says in verse 14, but even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed, and do not fear their intimidation, do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks to get you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. And keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right than for doing what is wrong. And then later on in chapter 4, he says it once again. In verse 12, he starts off with the same expression that John used. Beloved, do not be surprised. Do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of His glory you may rejoice with exaltation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in His name. What was promised to the Christians was to suffer. They were told by the Lord and then by the apostles, because of Christ, you're going to suffer. And why would they suffer? Why would people who would follow a man who taught men to love their neighbors and taught men to be righteous, but why would they hate him so? Why would they hate the master so much? He was no hypocrite. He did not say one thing and practice another. Why would they hate Him so, and why would they hate His people so? I think Jesus gives the answer in John 7 and verse 7 when He was talking to His siblings, His brothers, and they had kind of said to Him that they didn't believe, and they said, go up to Jerusalem and show yourself to all the people. They were kind of mocking Him. And Peter, or Jesus says to His brothers, He says, the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify against it that its deeds are evil. There's a key there. Why did the world hate Jesus so? The world hated Jesus so because He testified of it that its deeds were evil. You know, the world, brothers and sisters, can tolerate to some degree a righteous man and woman. When we live righteously and are doing the things in our lives that are right and good and proper, the world can tolerate that to some degree. But when we as Christians begin to speak out about the things that we see and say this is right or this is evil, the world now all of a sudden thinks we're meddling. And though they did not mind you living a righteous life before you got there, they do mind you saying anything about the kind of life they're living. And they will hate you because of it. And they hated Jesus because of it. And I think that's the key. Jesus spoke out against the evil that He saw. And when the gospel first goes forth from Jerusalem through the apostles and went through the whole Roman Empire, the apostles brought with them a message that was culturally unacceptable. It was contrary to the way people thought. The morality that was in the gospel, the salvation promises in the gospel, well, it was all contrary to the way the world was thinking. And when they would go forth preaching righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come, the world hated them for it. They were disturbed by what they were hearing and they didn't like it. And I say all this because the temptation to compromise with what's going on today needs to be thwarted. We need to stop and realize that the message of the gospel has never been culturally acceptable. And when we reach out to people with the gospel, we must not be ashamed of the message we are bringing to them. It is the saving message. You know, we've had some wonderful successes in Duluth. We've had people converted who are, like I said earlier, they're from the science department and they're studying sciences there in the university there in Duluth. And some of these people ask some hard questions. I remember when Heather was first a Christian, and this was the girl that was converted by Melanie, or introduced to the gospel by Melanie. And we were there, we were in Bixby's cafeteria one day, we were studying the first epistle of John. At least we were supposed to. And she looked at me, she said, "I have a question." And I said, "Okay." I said, I'll answer this question. And she says to me, I have a friend that's having a marriage problem. And I said, I said to myself, this is not good. This is not going in the direction I wanted to go in. She has a marriage problem. Her husband's a bad man, and I said, and hadn't been unfaithful, just don't like him anymore. Just, they don't get along anymore. And she's thinking about divorcing him. And she said, what do you think about that? And again, I thought to myself, this girl's brand new Christian, brand new Christian. And I thought to myself, how's this going to work out, you know? And of course, you're tempted to, well, ask me this next week or something like that. But anyway, I said, well, let's just open the Bible and see what it says. We turned to Matthew 19. We read what Matthew 19 says. And we read it out loud, and she looked at it, and I said, do you understand what it says? She says, yes, I do. And I said, and I understand the answer to my question. Isn't that neat? You know, instead of backing away from what the Bible says or somehow trying to hide it from people, we just read it. She understood it. Now, I'm going to say it's not going to happen that way all the time. But it does happen. We ought not to be afraid of what the message is. Another time, this same girl, along with Melanie and one other girl we were standing with, who's also in the science department, they had come to worship, and they were wondering, why do we not have any females in the leadership roles? Well, I'm thinking to myself, another. And I said, we'll talk about that in our next study, because I did have a couple of days. I didn't want to answer that right off the fly, because I figured we need to sit down and have discussion. And so I went to the university, and I had prepared some stuff, and I thought to myself, the only thing I can do is just read the scriptures and just hope for the best. And we read the scriptures, and these girls read around. I usually have people go to the Bible, and we read it out loud, and we go around the table reading the verses. And they all looked up at me, and she said, okay, we understand. I said, well, easy as that. I was so happy, I tell you. The temptation is to back away from this and somehow be apologetic. I'm so sorry the Bible says this. Let me tell you. First of all, we have no right to be sorry for the gospel. We have no right to make apologies for anything that Jesus taught through the apostles. It's His gospel, not ours. And all we have an obligation to do is present it and not apologize for it. And I think we need to remember Romans 1:16, where Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. We have no right to be ashamed of this wonderful message. But this other thing is that we should not be afraid to say what needs to be said when questions are asked. Now, we don't have to be ugly about it, and we don't have to talk about all the things that people are necessarily doing. Just answer their question from the Bible, and then let people be smart enough to draw the conclusions. I've learned over the years with these girls, or over the last few months with these ladies, that you don't have to sit there and put questions in their mouths. They have plenty of questions, and they'll ask when they're ready because they're smart people. But the thing is, I'm so happy to be meeting with people like this. Again, it doesn't always happen. There'd be some people who'd be very angry at what I said and very angry at what Paul said. No question about it. But my point is that let's not be afraid to tell people what they need to hear. We reach out to them. Sure, we would like to see more people join us in our worship and join us in our gatherings together. But we want them to join us as Christians. We want them to join us as disciples. People who understand what they're getting into. So let us not be afraid to say what needs to be said, and let us not be apologetic for anything the Bible happens to say about any topic. Let's preach it kindly. Let's preach it with humility. But let us never be apologetic for it, ever. Because the gospel has power, and there will be some who will be so happy to hear this and will embrace it, even though the message seems to be hard. And we find that even in the first century, you find people being turned to the Lord, turning to the Lord in great numbers, even though the message would end up causing them to be persecuted and reviled and scorned and hated, and yet they would still embrace it because they saw the value in it. And that's what we need to do, is show people the value of the gospel. Yes, explain to them they may have to suffer, But show them the value of the gospel and not hold back anything. And I tell you, we will grow in the way the Lord wants us to grow. We will grow, first of all, in our own strength, our own character, and our own faith. But we will get people to join the Lord and become His disciples who know what they're getting into. And that's what we want. People who know what they're getting into and people who understand that if they embrace this message, they will be treated differently and they will be scorned. And when topics come up which are not right, moral issues come up, let us not be afraid to say, this isn't right or this isn't what God says. Say it kindly, but say something and get people to think. Because this message is a wonderful message of life, and we, instead of being quiet about things, we need to speak out. And I guarantee when we start speaking out, we'll find the world will start treating us a lot differently. They will start seeing us as being radicals, and they will start perhaps ostracizing you and me more, but we must not be intimidated. We must not be intimidated by their fear, but we must keep trusting in the Lord and His power, which is in the gospel. And by doing this, the Lord will bless our efforts and bless our work.